The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live here at 3 o'clock Eastern on this Wednesday afternoon. With a quick programming note, I'll be mentioning this all week. As of Tuesday, because I don't do a show on Monday, this program will still remain here live at 3 Eastern at NicoleSandler.com. But if you listen on the Progressive Voices Network, they're moving my show to 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific. So just a programming note. We're still here, still doing it live on YouTube and at NicoleSandler.com at 3 Eastern. We'll just be delayed a few hours on Progressive Voices. So if you listen regularly there, you can either listen at 6 or come on over to YouTube or NicoleSandler.com/listen-live and hear it live there. Do it live. Yes, because we do it live. I've been doing radio for my entire adult life. I actually studied radio in college. My degree is in broadcast programming and production, and I've had a career in radio. And for a while in Los Angeles, I worked with a couple of guys who were from Birmingham, Alabama. Their names were Mark and Brian, and they were funny. They were definitely funny. And in the years I worked with them in LA, we ruled the morning airwaves in Los Angeles. Well, when they left Birmingham, there were a number of other shows that replaced them. And I'm guessing one of them was Rick and Bubba. Now, I had never heard of Rick and Bubba until this week when the president of the United States called in to the Rick and Bubba show to stump for Luther Strange, who was running in the Senate runoff. The election was held yesterday. Of course, Luther Strange lost to Judge Roy Moore. Now, I'm not up on my Alabama politics. Alabama is a state I've never been to. And aside from a couple of songs, good songs written about it, and good people from Alabama. I know we've got a couple who frequent the chat room every now and again. And I'm sure there are some other good people there. Good people everywhere. I really have no desire to ever visit Alabama. But you would have to be brain dead or just uninformed to not know who Judge Roy Moore is. Well, I'd heard about it, and today I decided to listen to at least some of that Rick and Bubba interview with Donald Trump. And luckily, the offending part came on pretty early. So Donald Trump calls in, and you know, his thing is he calls everyone by their first name. You know, that's the Chuck and Nancy thing, right? Well, he was talking about Luther, as in Luther Strange, and Ray, as in Ray Moore. What? Here, have a listen.
To me, very importantly, is that he will absolutely win against the Democrat.
He's talking about Luther Strange.
You know, Ray's going to have a hard time.
Ray.
You know that.
Ray's going to have a hard time.
It's going to be a hard race. You've seen those races go very bad over the years, whether it's Harry Reid's race or whether it's a couple of others that I won't even mention that were, you know, tough and they were not victories. And Luther wins automatically. If Luther wins tomorrow, the Democrats will hardly fight. If Ray wins, they're going to pour in $30 million like they did in Atlanta.
Okay, so he said it again. If Ray wins, now, I took the audio off of a video, and you could see the people in this studio just silently cracking up. They're laughing at the president because he doesn't know Roy Moore's name is Roy. And so Rick, I believe it was doing the main part of the interview. And he's talking to him, and he just very nonchalantly mentioned Luther and Roy. He called him Roy. And so then just a moment or two later, Donald Trump does this.
It might be that Roy Moore, as you say, because I don't know Roy Moore at all.
Right.
And I think it's perhaps indicative when somebody doesn't even know his name. You know, that's not a good sign.
Oh, God.
For him. But I have to say that, you know, I just don't know very much about him.
Right.
I know there's great controversy.
You think?
There's a lot of angst, but I don't know very much about Roy Moore.
So he's admitting on this radio show that he doesn't know anything about Roy Moore. In fact, last night he tweeted out, spoke to Roy Moore of Alabama last night, or it was this morning, last night for the first time. Sounds like a really great guy who ran a fantastic race. He will help to MAGA. Yeah. Hey, Donald, why don't you educate yourself a little bit about Roy Moore? Roy Moore, who lost his seat on the bench because he would not follow the law and remove this garish marble Ten Commandments display after being told to get it out of there because a biblical display does not belong in a public courthouse. Roy Moore, who believes that 9/11 was God's punishment because we're such a perverse society. Yes. Roy Moore, who thinks homosexuality should be outlawed. Donald Trump doesn't know anything about Roy Moore. Roy Moore, who doesn't know what a dreamer is, does not know who the dreamers are. He believes Obama wasn't born in the U.S. Well, neither does Trump, or at least he didn't. I don't know if he's changed his mind on that. I think Trump sort of apologized. Roy Moore hasn't. Roy Moore, who thought that Keith Ellison should not have been allowed to take the congressional oath of office on his Quran. Furthermore, thought he shouldn't have been allowed to serve in Congress because he was a Muslim. Bum, bum, bum. He believes there are U.S. communities under Sharia law. And just last week, Roy Moore referred to Native Americans and Asian Americans as reds and yellows. But Donald Trump is you know, congratulations, another tweet from last night. Congratulations to Roy Moore on his Republican primary win in Alabama. Luther Strange started way back and ran a good race. Roy, win in December. Now, why would he say that if he doesn't know a damn thing about this man? But this is how Donald Trump does everything. He knows nothing about anything. You know, he's talking about what a great job his administration is doing in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, where they're having this major humanitarian crisis, where people are literally dying. They don't have food. They don't have water. They don't have power. They don't have gasoline. And they can't get those things. They're dying. And Donald Trump is going to, he'll visit next week. And they'll bring up some extra funding for Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands in the first couple of weeks of October. Does he not understand that those people in Puerto Rico, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, are Americans? I think he doesn't. It's because we've elected an imbecile, ladies and gentlemen. An imbecile is the president of the United States. And that's a public service announcement from your pals here at the Nicole Sandler Show. Okay, so there's no sound coming from my page. Did I forget to? I think that, no, you guys should have sound there. All right, I'll tell you what, we'll take a break. We'll do What's News. We'll come back. We've got Victoria Jones with the news today. And then Wendell Potter will be with us. I know that they're telling us that Trump Care is dead. I say not so fast. It may be dead for now, but even Donald Trump said today, we've got the votes for it. We'll just have to bring it back in January, February, or March. I kid you not. We'll get to all of that on today's show. Don't go away. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Senate Republican leadership and the people behind the Graham-Cassidy Trump care bill Tuesday afternoon took to the microphones to admit they don't have the votes, declaring their latest effort to repeal and replace Obamacare dead for now. Senator Bill Cassidy said the vote will be postponed.
Well, to be clear, through events that are under our control and not under our control, we don't have the votes. Okay? That's in speaking to the leadership, speaking to the president. I think Lindsey and he are on speed dial. We've made the decision, since we don't have the votes, we will postpone that vote.
Lindsey Graham vowed it would be back.
The leadership team has done everything we've asked them. We're coming back to this after taxes. We're going to have time to explain our concept. We'll have a better process. And we're going to take this show on the road.
And Mitch McConnell is ready to pivot to tax cuts for the very rich.
We haven't given up on changing the American health care system. We are not going to be able to do that this week, but it still lies ahead of us, and we haven't given up on that. We do think it's time to turn to our twin priority, reforming the tax code. We've reached significant agreements inside the Budget Committee to go forward. And I'm optimistic that we'll achieve that.
Attention may now shift back to a bipartisan fix for Obamacare, spearheaded by Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander and Ranking Member Patty Murray. The president is heading to Indianapolis on Wednesday to roll out his tax overhaul plan, said to include an income tax surcharge on the wealthy and doubling the standard deduction given to most Americans. ABC has more of the details.
The plan would reduce the number of personal income tax brackets from 7 to just 3, slash the corporate tax rate by more than half, and eliminate all deductions except for home mortgage interest and charitable contributions. That means deductions for state and local income taxes will no longer exist, a potential blow to many Americans in high-income, high-tax states, including several East Coast blue states and California.
After mounting criticism of his seeming lack of concern for the people of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, Trump came out swinging Tuesday over charges that he's been preoccupied with the NFL kneeling controversy.
Well, I wasn't preoccupied with the NFL. I was ashamed of what was taking place. I have plenty of time on my hands. All I do is work. And to be honest with you, that's an important function of working. It's called respect for our country.
He then conflated the protests over police brutality with disrespect of our military.
Many people have died. Many, many people. Many people are so horribly injured. I was at Walter Reed Hospital recently, and I saw so many great young people, and they're missing legs and they're missing arms, and they've been so badly injured. And they were fighting for our country. They were fighting for our flag. They were fighting for our national anthem. And for people to disrespect that by kneeling during the playing of our national anthem, I think is disgraceful.
Trump then went on to say that despite all reports from on the ground, he and his administration are doing a great job in responding to the swarm of hurricanes from Texas to Florida to Puerto Rico and beyond.
The governor of Puerto Rico is so thankful for the great job that we're doing. We did a great job in Texas, a great job in Florida, a great job in Louisiana. We hit little pieces of Georgia and Alabama. And it's the most difficult job because it's on the island. It's on an island in the middle of the ocean. It's out in the ocean. You can't just drive your trucks there from other states. And the governor said we are doing a great job. In fact, he thanked me specifically for FEMA and all of the first responders in Puerto Rico. And we're also mentioning with that the U.S. Virgin Islands. It was devastated.
Trump announced that he'll go to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands on Tuesday and continued bragging about what a great job they're doing under tough circumstances.
The mayor of San Juan was very generous and very nice this morning, was thanking us for the great job we've done with FEMA. That we really have. We've worked very, very hard in Puerto Rico.
Doing a really good job? Let's hear from Carmen Yulin Cruz, the mayor of San Juan, speaking with Rachel Maddow.
There are boots on the ground. I see the FEMA people work very hard in meetings and getting the logistics together, but those boots need to start walking, and we need to start getting the supplies and the food and the water, just something as simple as drinking water. Electricity will not be here for another 6 months. And it is true. The power grid was very weakened before that. But we have no power grid at this point. So we are running from one place to another, canvassing and making sure that we find people alive before it is too late. And that is not a hyperbole. It is a fact of life in San Juan and in the rest of Puerto Rico.
And still not a word from Trump about all the people suffering. And finally, in the runoff for the Republican nomination to fill Jeff Sessions' former Senate seat from Alabama, former Justice Roy Moore came out almost 10 points ahead of Senator Luther Strange, the candidate Donald Trump endorsed. The controversial Moore, who believes homosexuality should be illegal and that the 9/11 attacks were punishment for our perversity, among other such insanity, will face off on December 12th against former U.S. Attorney, progressive Democrat Doug Jones. I got good news. And that's a bit of What's News for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these What's News reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, time to turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service, talkmedianews.com, for more of the news that's going on. I think we've got Victoria Jones on the line today. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, Ellen and I have swapped.
I know.
So she will be on instead of me tomorrow.
Okay. Well, that works. So, strange goings on, as there seem to be every day. There's a few stories that I want your take on, one of which bothers me because I have a daughter who is a naturalized citizen. She was born in Kazakhstan. You were born in the UK, I'm gathering from your accent. And there's this story about the DHS that's going to collect social media info on all immigrants?
Yes. I mean, unless this BuzzFeed story is massively wrong, and I have a Facebook friend who is a lawyer with all kinds of very interesting sort of spy-type clients and, you know, very interesting-type clients, who I messaged yesterday saying, hey, you know, you're going to be under scrutiny by the government. He said, I already am. I said, well, look at this. He's looking into it. It looks like it. What's going to happen is BuzzFeed News spotted this, and starting October the 18th, Homeland Security will be keeping social media information on all immigrants. That includes just regular immigrants, but also green card holders and naturalized citizens. And so this includes Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, aliases, the handles you use, and your posts.
Wow.
It would also include, suppose you and I are Facebook friends, and you are I wouldn't call you a rabid poster, but I would say that you're a keen poster on Facebook. It would mean that your posts would come under scrutiny.
Right.
Because I am a naturalized citizen, according to what they can glean from this. And the idea is that they want to see if these people are a threat.
Unreal. Unreal. And how are they going to go through it all? I mean, that's one of the problems they already have, is they've got that massive place, where is it, out in Utah, where they've got all this data, and they don't have enough people to go through all the data they're compiling.
Well, this is what's so extraordinary. How do you go through it all? I mean, I'm quite, not selective, but I'm lazy. I don't like Facebook, so I'm very slow and lazy about my Facebook friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of them, you know, So for example, with me, in theory, it's easy. But even suppose you've got 100 and 150 Facebook friends, how do you go through that many posts? And then you decide, a lot of my Facebook friends are business friends,
sure,
political friends,
right,
in the business. And so how do you decide what is a business post or what is a political statement? You know, and then are they going to use that to determine whether they are a threat? Are they going to be deciding something about, are they going to be judging political speech now? I'm not clear on this at all. And also, from what we can gather, My understanding is from civil liberties experts, people's social media postings have not been, by and large anyway, a reliable sign of whether they are going to be violent.
Right.
As they can
right.
be, but they aren't consistently.
I hear you. I hear you. You know, just so you know, I was alerted to this story yesterday by another adoptive parent, friend of mine, and she cited the Privacy Act of 1974, System of Records, and there's a post at federalregister.gov. So it sounds pretty legit to me.
Oh, yeah, no, there is a legit post. It was quietly inserted into the Federal Registry. It's open for the comment period right now. I'm waiting. It's been on Mashable. It's been on a few other places.
Mm-hmm.
And BuzzFeed News does some very good reporting. I'm waiting for someone like Charlie Savage in the New York Times to get his teeth into this. It's the kind of thing that he does a very good job. I mean, somebody, you know, is going to pick up on this. But if they can keep all our phone records, why wouldn't they do this?
Exactly. Just one more thing to be concerned about, because they are, Big Brother is watching. Yes, they are. So, Victoria Jones, do we have any more info on the tax reform details? I read about tax reform stuff, and my eyes roll back in my head.
Oh, you have the same response I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like me in math class. yes. Well, we are getting more details about the tax reform, but what I'm not clear about and what I'm not really understanding is, you know, they're going to repeal the estate tax, so, you know, we can see who this is going to benefit, and they're going to have three categories of tax rather than seven, things like that, individual rates
mm-hmm.
and all the business taxes and all these things. But what's not, they say most itemized deductions would be eliminated, tax incentives, mortgage interest, charitable deductions would remain, but they're not saying yet, and I don't think it's been worked out because it's going to be up to the tax writing committee, which itemized deductions would be eliminated, and this is what's tripped up so many attempts at reform before, because ultimately people don't want to give up their deductions.
Of course not. Well, one thing that I read that there would be taken away are your deductions for state and local taxes, which hits people from New York and California and Massachusetts and certain high-taxed states that tend to be more Democratic than Republican. It's going to hit those people really hard. The other thing is they hope to push this through the same way that they wanted to push through the health care reform, which is through reconciliation with just 50 votes. And John McCain already said he'll hold this to the same standard as he held health care. So, you know, hopefully those process people will stand firm.
They do hope to. They've already introduced the first bill that would put the reconciliation, whatever it is, in place. Democrats are obviously screaming foul. Bernie Sanders has been very vocal about it. Chuck Schumer has been very vocal about it. Ron Wyden from Oregon is live tweeting. Sanders called it morally repugnant. Ron Wyden from Oregon is going to live tweet and fact check President Trump's tax reform speech. And Wyden said, and I don't need 280 characters to do it.
Yeah, that's an awful lot for a tweet, isn't it?
Oh, don't get me started. I think it's ridiculous.
For those who don't know, Twitter today said that they're toying with the idea of, right now you're limited to 140 characters. They want to double that to 280. Then it's a Facebook post.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing of Twitter is that you've got to be succinct. I mean, that's what makes it clever.
Right. And you can scroll through a lot of information pretty quickly because they're all short little things. And if you want more, you click on the link and you get more.
Yeah, or somebody has to do three posts, or they give up and only do two posts because it's too much trouble to do three. I mean, you know, it stops people from going on and on and on, which is
right.
A good thing.
That's right. There are some who do long, you know, 20-tweet threads. That's the new thing these days. But there are only a rare few who can carry that off. Anyway.
Yeah, there are.
Did you notice when Trump was getting on, I guess, Marine One to leave to go to Indianapolis to give his tax reform details, such as they are, he was asked about Tom Price and his penchant for private planes, and he asked, "Is he going to be fired?" He said, "We'll see, we'll see."
Yes. Now this is very interesting because the House Oversight Committee is already looking at this, and Trump is not happy about it, and his. His words, we'll see. And he said a couple of other things, too. He said about three different things. He said the we'll see, and he said something else that indicated he would not confirm one way or the other whether Price would be. I mean, he likes to leave people hanging, like,
right.
Like he's left Jeff Sessions twisting in the wind for months on end. But, you know, so there's no guarantee of what he's going to do. But Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary, who has taken at least 24 flights on private jets and corporate jets, racking up about $300,000 in taxpayers' money since, I believe, May, is in trouble over this now and is being investigated by his department's inspector general.
Good. As he should be. And this is a guy who, before he was director of or secretary of Health and Human Services, used to rail against private jet travel. Not that I'm trying to remember who preceded him in the Obama administration. And I'm drawing a blank. But not that they ever did.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, also, Steven Mnuchin is under scrutiny as well.
Mm-hmm.
You'll remember that he tried to get a private jet to take him and his wife, the actress, whose name is escaping me, on a government jet for their honeymoon
yep.
for some bizarre reason.
Yep. And then you have
didn't get it.
Right. And then you have who is it? Another cabinet member getting a cone of silence.
That's right.
And I'm drawing a blank at who it is, but yeah, because somebody needs a cone of silence.
Yeah, I'm blanking.
Yeah, that happens.
Not a lame, neither of us can. Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that, listeners.
Anything else we need to know about today?
I think one of the other things that we do need to catch up on is Puerto Rico and aid to Puerto Rico
yes.
and where that stands. Very good story in the Associated Press today, talking to a number of people who live in Puerto Rico, who pretty much all of whom said, we haven't seen any aid. We haven't seen anybody from the government, from the Puerto Rico government. We haven't seen anybody from FEMA. We haven't seen anybody from the federal government. We're waiting.
Isn't that amazing?
In this story, it's a very good story, a very illustrative story describing what people are doing, how they're washing their hair in rivers and all these kinds. It's a very good story. But they must have spoken to six or seven different people. And it also says in the story that the response feels different than the response to previous disasters in its slowness. Also, Senator John McCain is pushing, in a letter, has renewed his push for legislation that would waive the Jones Act. And the Jones Act puts restrictions in place that he says, and Democrats also say, are stifling hurricane relief efforts.
Yes.
And he's urging acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke to get rid of this rule, which limits American ports from receiving goods only from ships that are American-owned and operated. Now,
wow.
And he's been really strong about this. And in the last month, DHS has waived the Jones Act twice. but won't do it this time. Now, interestingly, Trump was asked about that today. And I only heard his response on the radio driving home, but I haven't seen it in print. But one of the things that he said on his way to Indiana was that, well, no, we're looking at it. We're looking at, you know, the shipping companies oppose it. We're looking at it.
Yeah.
And thinking, so what if the shipping companies oppose it? There are people starving.
He said it in a tweet as well. He said it in a tweet as well. They raised the restrictions for Florida and Texas, but not for Puerto Rico. Why? Because these rich shipping companies don't want him to?
I don't know, but he actually said, because I heard the audio, heard him say, you know, the shipping companies oppose this. We're looking at it. I'm thinking, what do the shipping companies opposing it have to do with whether
anything
to waive it for emergency aid? I just thought it was an interesting thing to say.
It absolutely is. Victoria Jones from the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Coming up, an old friend of the show, you remember Wendell Potter. Wendell Potter was a health insurance industry whistleblower. He left Cigna. Hold on, I need to make sure I'm calling the right number. And was with us the entirety of the time of going through the whole Obamacare, hearings and the bill being written and debated and passed into law. He wrote all about it in his book, Deadly Spin, which is a great snapshot in time. It also proves how poorly the Republicans' lies are when they talk about how the Democrats just, you know, shoved this all through in the dead of night. No, this thing went on for a good 18 months, being written in three different committees, debated to death, amendments galore, lots of Republican amendments as well that Republicans voted for. And then when the final bill came up, even though their amendments were included in it, they voted against the final bill. Totally different process. Wendell Potter is also a journalist who's in the process of building and launching a new news organization called Tarbell, and we'll get into all of that. Hello, Wendell Potter.
Nicole, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. And you?
I'm terrific. Thank you very much. Glad to be on your show again.
Well, glad to have you back. And I know when I first contacted you and invited you on today, I thought we would be in the throes of still fighting to get that, you know, a final no to kill Graham Cassidy, also known as Trump Care. Thankfully, we got that, yesterday when the leadership and the namesakes of this bill came before the microphones and said, well, we just don't have the votes, after Susan Collins said she couldn't in good conscience vote for it. I don't really trust it. I refer to this as the zombie Trump Care bill because they're going to keep bringing it back. In fact, I don't know if you heard Donald Trump today. I'm going to play a little 20-second clip here, but here's what he said today.
The point is this. Health care, we have it. We have the votes. Because of reconciliation, we have to wait till January, February, or March, which we'll do. But in the meantime, I will negotiate with Democrats to see if we can make a bipartisan bill. Yes, John.
Now, I don't believe much of what he says, but as of yesterday, they didn't have the votes. Have you heard anything different?
No, I haven't. There's not much of a chance. It seems that this legislation will be back before Congress this year. I am hearing, you probably are too, and even the president says that next year is a different, it'll be different, and we may see this resurface again in January or sometime later in the winter or spring. So it's not dead finally. It's interesting that he would try to negotiate with Democrats. That's really quite interesting. As we know, there is some work that Senator Lamar Alexander and I think Patty Murray were leading to try to find some bipartisan legislation that could improve the Affordable Care Act. And I use that word maybe judiciously. I'm not sure it would be an improvement, but it'll be back, I think, probably in some form. after the first of the year. So we really can't relax and say this thing is over with.
No, and Wendell Potter, they have given us just in the almost 9 months since Trump has been in office, there was the House bill, the America's Health Care Act, right? The one that they actually passed, yep. And they had the big beer party to celebrate in the Rose Garden. Then the right. Senate got it, and they came out with the BCRA, the Better Care Reconciliation Act. That one went down. Then they tried to do a straight repeal. Then they tried to do the skinny repeal, and then they tried Graham Cassidy, which many people say was actually the worst of all of them. Did you read enough of it to know if the block grants to the states, taking all the Obamacare money and putting it out to the states in block grants, would that have been the worst of all of their schemes?
I do think that was probably the worst piece of legislation, certainly right up there among the worst. Because it would really eviscerate the Medicaid program for many states. And in fact, every state eventually, because it would just scale back funding for the Medicaid program. And what was left largely let the states just run without much direction from the federal government, which would be just catastrophic for a lot of people in many parts of the country. And it would, of course, have taken money. It would have penalized the states that have expanded Medicaid, that have really tried to do the right thing for their residents that are poor or have low incomes and need some support, need health care that they just simply can't afford to buy on the private market. So it would have been just absolutely devastating for so many people.
And that, in essence, is the reason Susan Collins came out against it. It's interesting. They were trying to buy off Lisa Murkowski by sweetening the pot, more money for Alaska. And in the end, I almost feel a little, bummed that they're not taking the vote, because I would like all these people to weigh in on it. I would expect that she would be a no. But now we don't know until the next time they bring it up, and they will bring it up again. The other interesting thing about this is all the organizations that came out against it, from the American Medical Association to AARP to American Cancer Society. The interesting one that I noticed was America's Health Insurance Programs, AHIP, which is the yes. lobbying arm of the health insurance industry. Right. Why were they against it?
Well, it wasn't just altruism on their part.
No.
One thing you have to keep in mind is that the insurance industry manages many of the Medicaid programs around the country. A lot of the states have essentially turned over their Medicaid programs to private insurance companies to manage. And so a lot of money flows to those insurance companies, and that would be revenue that they know they would lose. And the block grants would just really dry up a lot of the revenue that they've been getting. So that's one thing that you have to keep in mind. They knew that they too, or at least the member companies of AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, would suffer. Now, that said, there are within AHIP a number of nonprofit health insurance plans that I think, to a certain extent, trying to do a better job of providing access to care than some of their more Wall Street-driven competitors, like the ones that I used to work for. And so it's telling that they would weigh in. They don't typically do that. But when money is at stake, and that's why also you saw a lot of the hospital groups and physician groups weighing in as well, too. It would not only penalize regular Americans, but it would really result in cuts in revenue to both health insurers and healthcare providers all across the country for years and years to come.
The health insurance companies also did well during the Affordable Care Act, didn't they?
Yes.
Because there was
yes.
a mandate that everybody buy insurance. This brought them a lot of new
yes.
customers, didn't it?
Exactly right. And they would certainly miss that mandate. And one of the things that has been lost on a lot of people, and certainly Republicans, is that the health insurance industry really needs that individual mandate for the private market to work, at least for those who do not get coverage through the workplace. And that is a lot of people. And in fact, it is protection for a lot of people. Even if you have a job through the workplace, there's no assurance that you're going to have that till you're ready to retire. So a lot of us, even if we have employer-sponsored insurance, we need to have the assurance that coverage will be there for us, that insurance companies cannot blackball us, they can't deny us coverage, they can't charge us more for pre-existing conditions. All that would go away if these repeal bills would be were to have passed. So we always need to be mindful of that. And, yeah, again, for the insurance companies, it has been beneficial to them and almost, well, in fact, every one of the for-profit insurance companies has made out like gangbusters since the Affordable Care Act was enacted because of the additional revenue that they've received.
You know, Wendell Potter is with us, and I, you know, because I've known you, because we've been talking about this stuff for so long already. It was back in the Air America days. We were talking, you know, during as they were writing and debating and having hearings on the Affordable Care Act. But I do have a lot of listeners who may not really know who you are. They just know Wendell Potter, and it sounds like you used to work for an insurance company. Why don't you give the short version of what brought you to this place?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying that I'm a former journalist. I was a newspaper reporter in my first career, and I, in my first jobs in journalism were in my home state of Tennessee, but I ultimately was able to cover Congress and the White House and Supreme Court for Scripps Howard newspapers for quite a while. But then I had a longer career in corporate public relations. I was head of communications for two big for-profit insurance companies, Humana and then Cigna, where I worked for almost 15 years. And I saw a lot, obviously, and learned a lot during those 20 years working in the insurance industry. I ultimately came to realize that what I was doing for a living was helping to perpetuate a very dysfunctional healthcare system. And I knew I was part of the problem. And I knew that much of the work that I was doing, quite frankly, was the exact opposite of what I tried to do as a journalist. I realized I was in too many cases willfully misleading the public in some ways by omitting important information or just selling a bill of goods like what we referred to as consumer-directed care, high-deductible plans, which the industry has been working for many years to move us all into. So I left after a crisis of conscience, and I ultimately, during the healthcare reform debate in 2009, decided to begin speaking out, and I testified before Congress a number of times in 2009 and 2010 prior to the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. And since then, I have written books. Deadly Spin was my first book, which was kind of an account of what I used to do for a living, and it describes how big entities like the health insurance industry and others are able to manipulate public opinion to influence public policy. And my most recent book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. So I've been pretty darn busy since I left my corporate career. And in many ways, Nicole, I said that what I'm doing now is trying to make amends for years that I know that I was helping to keep a lot of people from getting the coverage they needed and to perpetuate a very broken healthcare system.
Right. So if any of these repeal plans had gone through, what I kept thinking is this is just going to take us back to where we were, the dark ages, as it were, before the Affordable Care Act came into being, when I could have been denied the ability to buy a policy because of a pre-existing condition, or you know, the insurance company could drop you if you get sick. Now, and as the different people would come out and speak about these, for instance, with Graham Cassidy, they kept insisting that, oh, no, it's still got protections for pre-existing conditions. They just lie about that stuff, don't they?
So they do. We've entered an era in American politics in which lying is accepted. And, you know, we've always had a system in which politicians and others have tried to mislead us, but the outright lies that we've been seeing, quite frankly, since the campaign of last year and the Trump administration, it's just breathtaking that members of Congress seem to have no reservations whatsoever about telling bald-faced lies. The Graham Cassidy legislation, if who knows, maybe the sponsors didn't even know what was in their legislation, and I wouldn't be surprised if that were not the case. People would not have had protection under that legislation if it had been passed. And it would have been worse than what we had before because, as we spoke earlier, it would have really cut the Medicaid program very, very deeply. And a lot of people who have depended on the Medicaid program, many of them, you know, obviously were temporary period of time, it just would not be available to people like it has been historically.
Right. And for some people, they finally got some health care for the first time in forever. And then, you know, they want to take it away. I had always heard, or the line we kept hearing was, you know, once you get an entitlement, and I hate that word, but we'll use it for lack of a better one. Once you get an entitlement, it's awfully hard to take it away. This Republican Party is trying their damnedest to take away all of what they call entitlements, from health care to Social Security to Medicare, things we pay into. That seems to be their goal.
It is the goal for many of them. Certainly you look at libertarians like Rand Paul, who don't see any role for the government to play in helping to assure that people get the coverage that they need or the access to the care that they need. So philosophically and ideologically, they're opposed to the government playing any role in helping us to get access to care. Then you've got others who want to have a much reduced federal government or government period. They're federalist, which means that they want to return as much power or give the states as much power as possible. That enables them, of course, to say that they can cut taxes. And this vehicle, and many of these vehicles, as you know, have been not only to reduce the number of people with coverage, but to free up money that is being spent right now to help people get access to care or get care that they need, to free that money up so that they can give tax cuts to the wealthy and their benefactors, which has been what motivates a lot of them. So there are a lot of reasons for this. All that said, there are some members of Congress who are Republicans, like Susan Collins, mm-hmm. and I think like Lisa Murkowski, who understand that the federal government does have an important role to play in making sure that we, as Americans, regardless of where we live, not just in Alaska and Maine, that we get the coverage that we need and the care that we need.
Donald Trump earlier today said he's going to sign an executive order, maybe today, that would allow us to cross state lines to buy insurance. I never got this argument. Why would that be a good thing? Why would that help?
Oh, it wouldn't help. In fact, it's just misdirection here. He campaigned on that for months, as you may recall. That he said that we just need to remove the invisible lines around states and allow insurance companies to sell policies across state lines. Well, first of all, there is no federal prohibition against it.
Right.
They can do it right now if they want to, and they could for a long time. So that's something that they are obscuring for, you know, obviously political reasons. But because he said it during the campaign, he sees this as a way to deliver on that promise. He can do that. He can sign whatever he wants. But that's not going to do anything to encourage health insurance companies to sell policies across state lines. There are a lot of reasons why that just does not work. One is it's very expensive to set up operations in a state where you don't already have operations.
Right.
The state of Georgia, where Tom Price is from, where he was a congressman, that state a number of years ago, after the Affordable Care Act was passed, threw out the open mat to insurance companies in surrounding states, in my home state of Tennessee, and in Florida, and South Carolina, and Alabama, to come in and do business here. Not a single insurance company in all of those states, and there's some pretty darn big ones that are right around Georgia, Florida, your state in particular,
right.
had no interest in doing it.
Right.
Had no interest in doing it because it costs so much money. You have to have, and it just reflects an ignorance of how private insurance really operates. It's a chicken and the egg kind of thing. If you don't have a lot of customers already, you cannot negotiate very favorable rates with healthcare providers. And if you don't have favorable rates with healthcare providers, you're not going to be able to offer very good rates to your customers. So There are just a lot of reasons why it's a good talking point, and people who don't understand the health insurance business think, well, yeah, why not? Let's go ahead and do that. But it just is something that doesn't work.
Right. Now, they'd have to administer what they sell, and if they're not set up in that state, it's a whole other expense and headache. And look, they can barely administer in their own states, let alone adding on other states.
And one final point on that, the Federalists who want to give control to the states and let the states run the systems the way they want to, all the states have different regulations, and that's another reason. Insurance mm-hmm. companies would have to abide by all different kinds of regulations. It adds to administrative burden and expense, and they just don't have any interest in doing that.
So now we still have the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare is still in place. They weren't able to get rid of it. It used to be enrollment started like in mid-November. We don't know for sure when it's going to start because they don't want to tell us. We will find out and we'll get the information out. It'll only be six right. weeks as opposed to 8 weeks. They've done away with the money for navigators to help. But the bottom line is it will be there. The question mark is the cost sharing reductions. Or the risk corridors, are those the same things?
They are different. A lot of the money from the risk corridor provision of the Affordable Care Act is not available, and it's one of the reasons why premiums have been going up in recent years. Republicans point to rising premiums, but quite frankly, they're a cause of it. Marco Rubio, in particular, was able to get a lot of those payments that went to insurance companies during a time when there was a need to stabilize this marketplace, individual marketplace, that went away. So insurance companies they jacked up their rates as a consequence. They were not getting that money that had been promised under the law. But the cost sharing reduction money has not been eliminated, and that would require an act of Congress, as I understand it. So that's not going away. But all this time of uncertainty in which insurance companies and the rest of us were trying to wonder, you know, trying to figure out, or we're just left to speculation, will there be a repeal that is passed or not, and what happened? So insurance companies, you know, with that uncertainty, and what they've done for their policies for 2018, they've, as they say on Wall Street, have baked in some rate increases because of the uncertainty.
Wow.
And it just means that a lot of people will be paying more for coverage simply because of what's been going on and what the Republicans have been doing over, you know, this entire year.
Sabotage is what it is.
It's sabotage.
Yeah.
It is. It's sabotage. And I suspect that they will, when the premiums are announced, they will once again say, you know, they'll point the finger of blame at the Democrats and mm-hmm. on Obama and say it's not working, and that's what they will undoubtedly try to build their efforts after the first of the year. So we've got to be mindful of that. They will do that. We know they'll do that, but it will be really largely because of what they have been doing.
You know, Wendell Potter, when I brought you on and asked you to, you know, tell us what brought you here, you said you were a former journalist. You're actually a current journalist as well. You are in the process of launching a new news organization called Tarbell. We spoke about it a couple of months ago. What's the update on it?
Yeah, Nicole, I might say that, yeah, I have always felt like I am supposed to be a journalist, and I've joked at times that those 20 years I served in the insurance industry, I was undercover for as a journalist. So I learned a lot, and I'm going to put a lot of that knowledge to use. What Tarbell is a new independent, nonpartisan digital journalism platform that will be a blend of investigative journalism and solutions journalism. We'll be investigating corruption, and not just corruption in Washington and Tallahassee and the state capitals. We'll be looking at who is financing the corruption. And by that I mean the big insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, who are able to write big checks to influence elections and public policy. We'll describe how they go about doing it, what's in it for them, and how it affects every one of us. A lot of people are upset about all the money that's spent on politics, and for good reason. But there's not much of an awareness of how it all happens and how we're affected day by day. And that's what we will be doing. We're also going to be investigating solutions. We're not going to say, for example, that we have to have a single-payer system and it's the only way to go, but we will describe what it is and how it works and how the systems in Canada and the UK work and other developed countries, and showcase things that work and that we should consider in this country. We'll also be helping people understand how they can get involved and helping them to understand the importance of people to become very active citizens, not just to vote, as important as that is, but to get involved in supporting issues that they care about. And we'll explain and tell people how they can go about doing that.
Is there a target date for it? I know that at tarbell.org, yeah, it's up there with a lot of information, but yeah, it's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress. So what we're going to be doing is something that's never been attempted in this country. We're going to be launching a very ambitious crowdfunding campaign in mid-October. So stay tuned. Do go to tarbell.org and sign up for updates. We're going to be launching our crowdfunding campaign in mid-October. We are hoping to raise $1 million to give us the money that we need to begin our journalism around the first of the year. And we intend to be entirely reader-funded. We will not accept advertising or even any sponsored content or anything like that. We want to be owned by the readers. We want our readers to be members of Tarbell, to be owners and to help us determine what stories to cover, and to be subject matter experts and just to be involved in the whole process.
Tarbell is named for Ida Tarbell. Who was she?
Ida Tarbell was one of the most important journalists in American history, and it's especially notable in that she was working at a time when there were not many women reporters, period, and she was one of the first investigative reporters. She and some of her colleagues were called muckrakers, and her reporting was so important, it led to the breakup of one of the biggest conglomerates and monopolies of the day, John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil Company, and also to some very important antitrust and campaign finance law. So she's our guiding spirit. She and her fellow muckrakers really focused on the robber barons of the day, the corporate robber barons. And that's what we're going to be doing for our day.
I love it. So again, it's tarbell.org. And we can follow along the progress there. Wendell Potter, real quick, one last question on health care. Now that the repeal and replace is over, for now anyway, again, everything is temporary, I believe. Do you think they'll go back to letting Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray try to work out something on the cost reduction, cost sharing reductions, and to try to get the markets a little more stable, or is that a dead deal?
I don't know. I trust it will go forward. I do think that Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray were giving a good faith effort, and I certainly hope that leadership permits that to go forward. Whether or not anything can come up that will win support of enough Democrats and Republicans to go forward, we won't know. But I think they're honorable people trying to do the honorable work, and Lord knows we need to have some bipartisanship in Congress these days.
Yes, we do. And as you heard that clip I played, Trump said he'll negotiate with the Democrats to see if they can come up with something better. Then again, he said he has the votes for his repeal, which, no, they don't. So,
right.
Oh, boy. Wendell Potter, yeah, it's very good to talk with you. Thank you so much for your font of information, and I always appreciate your expertise.
Thank you so much, Nicole. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Anytime. Bye-bye.
Wendell Potter. Again, you can find him on Twitter at Wendell Potter. Tarbell.org is the website for Tarbell. And you can go to WendellPotter.com as well. He's got all kinds of information, interviews and articles that he's written, and his books and everything up there. And that brings us to the close of a Wednesday program. Tomorrow is Thursday, so Howie Klein will be here for a look at politics. I'm curious to know, I've been reading about Doug Jones, the guy who will be running against Roy Moore, you know, the senatorial candidate that Donald Trump really doesn't know anything about. And find out what, you know, what Howie knows about Doug Jones. He was described to me somewhere as a progressive. So we'll see if that's indeed the case. But then again, anybody, my dog Jackson, would be a better senator than Roy Moore. All right. And one more time, let me tell you, this is our last week at the 3 p.m. Eastern slot on Progressive Voices. Next week, we move to 6 p.m. Eastern, though the live show will continue from 3 to 4 Eastern at NicoleSandler.com and on YouTube. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone.